Okay, welcome everyone. Thank you so much for taking the time to join me this evening to commemorate Rabbi Dr. Moshe David Tendler, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. It's difficult. I'm so used to saying Shlita at the end. To say Zatzal at the end is already a painful change. But I first just want to acknowledge all the members of our shul who are here. Thank you for joining, in particular our president who is with us as well, Toby Schaefer. And also, again, the rabbis and professors, some of whom have logged on. Again, Rabbi Sayani, Dr. Brill, and Ms. Alana Bauman from the school, as well as many numbers and things that I don't recognize. But again, I really appreciate you coming this evening to commemorate Rabbi Tendler's memory. And so this is recorded for other people. Other people will see this recording, but I think the advantage of you being here is I'll give my, I guess you call it a eulogy, a presentation. I'll share my reflections. And then at the end, I'll try to keep some time for Q&A. The first thing I just really want to emphasize is that one has to know their own limits. I by no means am an authority on Rav Tendler. I'm not an authority on what his psukim were. I mean, I'm familiar, of course, with his psukim on swordfish, how he thought he had a strict definition of scales. I'm, of course, familiar with his psak on the time of death, on brain death, his whole machlokas, his Rabbi Bleich and Rav Herschel Schechter, as well as his position on tchelos as well. But I don't claim to be an expert. What I do claim simply is that I spent significant time with Rebbe for the last 3 years of his life. During the last 3 years of his life, I was zocheh to be in his shiur at Yeshiva University. And 1 year outside of YU here, I still made sure to be makdish time, to consecrate time to be with Rav Tendler. And during those 3 years, one of those 3 years actually, I was actually learning with Rav Tendler bechavrusa. And so that's a one-to-one relationship that we had on a very regular basis for an entire year going into COVID. And so there's certain anecdotes and certain lessons that I think naturally I was only privy to that I want to share with all of you. So I'm just going to first pin my video here for the recording. And again, I'll make time for questions at the end. You know, it was very kind was Rachel Fried. She's a granddaughter of Rav Tendler. She reached out to me and she said the nicest thing that in halacha, in Jewish law, sometimes it's a little limiting because it only recognizes the relatives. But in truth, many of us who were Talmidim, were students of Rav Tendler, we felt like he was our family. He felt like we were his family. And I'll share some reflections, some experiences of where Rav Tendler, and I'm saying this in a positive way, felt less like a Rosh Yeshiva to me and more like a grandfatherly figure. And so it's a bit of a not just intellectual loss, but for me personally, it's an emotional, it's a personal loss as well. And so as the Gemara in Menachos and Bava Basra says that Moshe Rabbeinu, according to one opinion, he wrote the final words of the Torah, Bedimah, in tears. And while Moshe Rabbeinu, he had the benefit of God dictating the words directly to him. So even when he lacked the composure, he was able still to write the words down. I pray that what I put together this evening, even though, of course, God certainly did not dictate the words to me, I pray that Hashem at least gave me some form of siyata dishmaya in order for, at least for Rav Tendler's sake, to commemorate him properly. And so even though it's right now, it's still a middle of Shiva, it's Shas Chimam. It's still a very difficult time. We're still in the thick of things, still trying to gather our thoughts. Like I tell to, as you know, the congregants who are on here, as you know, I advise that one cannot do an adequate job eulogizing someone at the funeral. There's no way if someone really feels emotionally connected that they can give a fully adequate eulogy summarizing someone's life. Maybe at Shloshim, maybe 12 months later at the Hakamas Matseva. But I think nonetheless, there is a value at this moment to share the lessons that I know and to see what we can take away from that. So, Marissa, are you able to? All right, thank you. So, number one, Rav Tendler, of course, doesn't need me to, I don't need to say this. Rav Tendler was a Gadol Hador B'fnei Atzmo. on his own merits, in his own right, we know Rav Tendler was a Gadol Dor, one of the leading rabbinic luminaries of our generation. But before I delve into Rav Tendler, and sometimes it's a little unfair, some people limit him, they pigeonhole him only into this. Rav Tendler, of course, was a conduit for understanding his esteemed father-in-law, Rav Moshe Feinstein. And so some of those instances where Rav Tendler elucidated Rav Moshe's position were clear. When you think about the case, for instance, of the Siamese twins, that was one of the most critical and famous medical ethics cases that Rav Moshe Feinstein ruled on, where he had these two kids that were together. And generally we say, "Ein dochin nefesh mipnei nefesh." We don't kill one person to save another person's life, but that's what they had to do. They had to kill essentially one baby to save the other baby's life. Can they do that surgery? And Rav Moshe Paskin that they could go forward. I was looking for that tshuva of Rav Moshe. Where did he write about that? And I was so shocked to see there was no tshuva of Rav Moshe on the topic. Instead, Rav Tendler shared with me actually an article that he published in the Torah V'Horah Sefer Zikar L'Maran HaGadol Rav Moshe Feinstein, a publication of Mesifta Teferis Yerushalayim. And in that journal, he published an article where he elucidated Rav Moshe's rationales. That's something he did publicly for Rav Moshe. But also what I found in my own experience was that I was privy to insights to Rav Moshe that I don't believe have been published publicly, but I believe he would be okay with me sharing it. One such instance is when we think about what was one of the most revolutionizing tshuvas of Rav Moshe, especially in kashrus. Of course, it's tshuva on the Chalav Stam. The fact that he said if the FDA were to catch people switching cow's milk for non-kosher milk, they would bring the law down upon them. So therefore, in America, we know when we're getting cow's milk, we're truly getting cow's milk. And it was a controversial tshuva. He invoked Anan Sahadi, the lumpus there. It's fantastic. But at the end of the tshuva, and Rav Moshe's actual personal practice was that Rav Moshe did not drink Chalav Stam. He drank Chalav Yisrael. And so I asked Rav Tendler, knew Rav Moshe Feinstein was willing to be mater Chalav Stam for all of America. What? Did he not trust his own psak? Was he okay being mater everyone else to drink something potentially non-kosher, but he wanted to do it himself? And so Rav Tendler gave me an insight that is not what I was told, is not what many suggest about Rav Moshe. Many say, in Ochinami, Rav Moshe Feinstein was very makbid on Chalav Yisrael. He wasn't comfortable with his own psak. However, Rav Tendler told me, actually, that based on the Gemara and Ksubos, there's a story of Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, it's a fantastic story, that he's visited by the angel of death. And the angel of death, you know, they go on a tour together and he brings him into the Garden of Eden. And Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi actually steals the sword of the angel of death. And until God intervenes, he basically tries to stop the angel of death from killing anyone. Eventually God intervenes, says, give the sword back. There needs to be death in this world. But what happened was Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi was permitted to stay in Gan Eden. He was allowed to enter alive. Why? Because he never annulled a neder. He was never matur nedarim. He never annulled a vow, a commitment that he had. So Rav Tendler told me that Rav Moshe was a concern from a kosher standpoint. He said that all my life until I came to America, I kept Chalav Yisrael. And so if I don't have to change a minhag, since it's such a huge schus, a huge merit not to change one's stringent practices, they don't have to. Even though, yes, from a kosher standpoint, Chalav Stam is 100% kosher, mahadrin and mahadrin, nonetheless, I'm not going to do it for an external reason due to the concern of changing my practice, of changing my minhag. That's not what the Velt usually says. But that was an insight that I got only because I inquired of Rav Tendler. And so when Rav Tendler and I, a little bit later down the line, when we're learning Bechavrusa, we're learning one-on-one, and I told him I was beginning my rabbinic job search, and thank God it worked out well. I'm here with all you guys at Stanford today, Baruch Hashem. So Rav Tendler said to me, he said, you know what? We're going to change our limud. We're going to change what we're studying. Instead of learning, I think it was Hilchos Shabbos at the time, we're learning Maseches Shabbos and Hilchos Shabbos. He said, I'm going to compile a list of what I consider to be the most, in his words, the most critical tshuvos in the Igros Moshe of Rav Moshe Feinstein that a Rav, that a rabbi needs to know in his career. And so, I mean, sadly, you know, we didn't get to the end of that list because he got sick and we weren't able to continue, but there, the insights he gave on those tshuvos were fantastic. And alas, I wish I took notes on them at the time. But I remember one tshuva I think we started off with was a tshuva about how if congregants don't want to shake the rabbi's hand, they want, you know, usually some shuls, I'm not sure what we did, I came during COVID, but in many shuls, the practice is that after you get an aliyah at the Torah, you go up to the stage and you shake the rabbi's hand. But in some shuls, either because they didn't like the rabbi or just, I mean, think about it, in our sanctuary, you know, you have to walk a mile to get up there and climb up that hill to get to the rabbi. So Rav Moshe wrote a whole tshuva, how he said that it's a huge affront. You have to go up to shake the rabbi's hand, and that's kavod talmidei chachamim. And actually, there might be dinei mamnus, there might be monetary ramifications. And Rav Tendler thought that that was an important tshuva for me to internalize. So it's okay, though. I'm mochel. Certainly during COVID, don't come up and shake my hand. Otherwise, I'll have to purell it for the millionth time. So I'm definitely mochel on that. So nonetheless, even though Rav Tendler was, as I said, a conduit, I don't want to emphasize this too much because I want to get to Rav Tendler himself. You know, Rav Tendler was a conduit for understanding Rav Moshe better in ways that no one else explained. There were occasions that Rav Tendler actually, he disagreed with Rav Moshe. One such instance, and again, the folks here at Agudat Shalom will appreciate this one, and we did this in a shiur together. There was an instance in a tshuva where Rav Moshe came down really hard on shuls that open up their parking lots on Shabbos. Yes, I can see you guys all putting your hands over your head. That's what we have here in our community. So Rav Moshe Feinstein, if you remember from our shiur, I think it's about a year ago at this point when I was brave enough or stupid enough to teach it at the shul, Rav Moshe Feinstein said, not only is a shul that opens its parking lot to welcome people to drive in on Shabbos violate lifnei iver lo sitein michshol, which generally, when I help someone, I facilitate someone else doing a sin, I am punished due to lifnei iver lo sitein michshol. Don't place a stumbling block in front of a blind person. It doesn't just mean literally a stumbling block, but it means putting a sin in front of somebody also is a spiritual stumbling block. That's what most poskim say. Rav Moshe took it to the next step. And he said, not only is it lifnei iver, but you are the category of a mesis. What's a mesis? A mesis is a special category, someone who basically entices others and tries to seduce them to worship avodah zarah, to worship idolatry. And that person, you don't have any mercy upon him. You come down hard with the full force of Beis Din, and the Adam come to him first. Terrible. It's like the worst thing it could possibly be. And that's what Rav Moshe categorized it as. People who leave their parking lots open and invite people to drive in on Shabbos. So Rav Tendler said to me, he said, look, I obviously am not encouraging people to drive. It's Havara. You're making a fire in Shabbos when you drive. But nonetheless, I thought Rav Moshe maybe took it a little too harshly with the category of mesis. So Rav Tendler was willing to unequivocally disagree with Rav Moshe when he thought on the rare occasion Rav Moshe was incorrect. But of course, he did so with reverence and with great respect for his father-in-law. So if you permit me just one more thing about Rav Moshe, actually not about Rav Moshe, but actually about Rav Moshe's daughter, which of course was Rav Tendler's wife. After I developed enough rapport with Rebbe, I finally, like, I was curious and I wanted to learn more about Rebbe as a person, not just as a Rosh Yeshiva. And so I asked Rebbe, I wanted to inquire how he met his wife. You know, how did he meet the daughter of Rav Moshe, Shifra Feinstein? So I, you know, was still developing rapport with Rebbe at the time. I wasn't fully comfortable asking it point blank. So instead, what I asked was, I asked, how did Rebbe become connected with Rav Moshe? Rav Tendler picked it up right away. He's like, ah, so how did I meet my wife? Okay, let me tell you the story. And the way it goes, the way Rav Tendler told it to me, and maybe there's different versions of how he said it in his life, I'll tell you the way he told it to me, was that back in the day, there was apparently this library on the Lower East Side where all the Jewish kids would go to hang out. You know, kind of like at YU today. There's the library. That's where people go. They attempt to find a mate. It doesn't really work out so well because everyone's awkward at YU with co-ed interactions. But that's for another time. But there was this library where all the Jewish kids, the boys and girls, would go to hang out. Ralph Taylor was there, chuckling back and forth. I believe he studied at NYU, so he's studying biology at the time as a college student. And then a girl approaches his desk, his table where he's studying, and has a shyla for him in biology, a shyla for him in science. Who was this girl? It was none other than Shifra Feinstein, the daughter of Moshe Feinstein. So fast forward, sometime later, Rav Moshe approaches Rav Tendler's father. Now, Rav Tendler's father, Rav Moshe, actually, they were colleagues. In fact, I believe Rav Tendler told me that in certain instances, they sat on the same basin. So they were very close. They ruled on the same rabbinical courts. Rav Moshe goes over to Rav Tendler and says, look, you have a good son. I have a good daughter. Let's read a shidduch. Let's make them get, let's suggest that they get married. Let's see if they're good for each other, if they're compatible. Rav Tendler thinks that's a marvelous, Rav Tendler's father thinks it's a marvelous idea. So he approaches his son, he approaches Rav Tendler and says, you know, this is what Rav Moshe suggested to me. Nu, would you be amenable to going out on a date with his daughter, with Shifra? And so Rav Tendler responded to him and said, I think that's a great idea and I appreciate you suggesting it, but don't worry, I already got this taken care of. I'm already pursuing that lead. Thank you very much. And so when you hear about all these stories about, you know, usually we hear about this Rebbe and this Gadol, they make a shidduch, and then the two kids, they meet in a hotel lobby, and after a few dates, they get married. So, you know, sometimes people meet through a shidduch, sometimes people don't. Sometimes it's Eliezer bringing back the shidduch for Yitzchak, and other times it's Yaakov going to meet Rachel. And this is like an instance of Yaakov going to meet Rachel, where Rav Tendler and his future wife, Shifra, they met actually on their own, which, as I know you've all watched Fiddler on the Roof, that's, of course, scandalous in the traditional community. And so on a more poignant note, when I was at the Levi, I went to Muncie, and, oh my gosh, everyone was packed into the Rav Tendler shul in Muncie. Baruch Hashem, masks were strictly enforced. Everyone's wearing masks, but people were like flowing out the doors. And it took me like I was constantly inching myself forward until one guy left his seat. And then I said, you're not coming back. I jumped in his seat. And I finally got a seat like an hour and a half in. And perhaps one of the most poignant things that I heard at the funeral was that Rav Tendler, as we heard, he passed away on Shmini Atzeres over Yontif. But what I didn't realize was that Shmini Atzeres was also the birthday of his wife, Shifra. And so the way the children and the grandchildren described it is, we're told by Chazal that a tzaddik, like Moshe Rabbeinu, they die on the same day that they were born. And so Rav Tendler, so to speak, his half of his neshama, he wasn't fully complete until he was married. Half his neshama, his wife, was born on Shmini Atzeres. And so it was only apropos that HaKadosh Baruch Hu kept Rebbe alive long enough that he was able to return to be complete with the other half of his soul to go back to his wife who was waiting in heaven for him. And so the way the children put it, it was like a birthday present for their mother that Rav Tendler finally got to be reunited with his wife on the day that she was born. So I thought that was a particularly poignant note. And with that, we'll conclude talking about Rav Moshe for now. And I want to talk more about my own experiences with Rav Tendler personally. Rav Tendler was known to be a firebrand, right? Let's just say it as it is. He was known to be a zealot. He spoke his mind. I think there was a Jewish Telegraphic Agency article. The title went something like, Rabbi Moshe Tendler thinks you're wrong and he's not afraid to tell you. It's something like that. And while it's funny because in the last 3 years of life, I think he mellowed a little bit because, you know, I had Rav Tendler here like this grandfatherly figure. Now, he certainly had his opinions. He certainly still believed what he believed 30 years ago. Nothing changed. I remember actually sitting with him before COVID in his office, and he was telling me how he was working with a group of rabbis to petition the Israeli government that they should maintain Orthodox standards for who's considered a Jew, for what's considered marriage. As we know, that didn't exactly succeed as of late, but he was still, it's Christian Bible statement, but fighting the good fight, so to speak. He was still fighting for Orthodoxy, fighting for what he saw to be MS, even at the final stages in the final chapter of his life. Nonetheless, even though Rav Tendler had his convictions, and he spoke very strongly when he was convinced that he was right, I got to see a side of him that also displayed his humility, his intellectual honesty, that there are times that he could be wrong as well. He's only a human being, a very great, wise human being, but a human being fallible like anyone else. Actually, I'm not going to test you guys right now, but if you remember the shiur that I gave for the shul for Agudas Shalom, my interview, anyone remember? Hachacham sha'asar, I see Toby remembers. Hachacham sha'asar in chavei rashei lahatir, which essentially it's in the Gemara Nida and Avodah Zarah. In layman's terms, it means don't go shopping for a heter. Don't go shopping for a rabbi. If one rabbi gave you a psak, don't go to a second rabbi to get that psak overturned. And so I was preparing the shiur for the shul for my interview, and I asked Rebbe at the time, I said, what are you paskin on this? Because there's a chakira on this sugya. There's a chakira, a dichotomy, how to understand why you're not supposed to go to a second rabbi. Is it because you are just halakhically bound by the first psak that was given to you? Or you're not bound by it per se, but for you and for the second rabbi to give a psak contrary to the first rabbi is an affront to his dignity. It's an affront to the kavod of the first rabbi. When I asked Rav Tendler what he paskin, he said to me, and I guess I deduced what he held in the sugya, he said that if someone comes to him and asks him a shayla, and they don't really feel comfortable with what Rav Tendler says, he says, by the way, I permit you, you're welcome to get a second opinion. You're welcome to go to another rabbi if you don't feel comfortable with what I told you. And in fact, I remember, thank God it wasn't halacha lemaisa, it wasn't practical, but I wanted to know I'd say God forbid, but I mean, it's only inevitable that I will deal with these shilohs of abortion that come up. For Moshe Feinstein, again, one of his most scathing tshuvos was on abortion, where he basically determined that abortion was murder. That's what he took the most extreme position on it. Unlike the Tzitz Eliezer, unlike Sridi Eish, unlike many others, but that's where Moshe held, which gives you very little leeway to be lenient if the mother's life is not in danger. So I asked Rav Tendler, like, Rebbe, if I go to you from Sock on these matters, but I'm looking for some flexibility, is that possible? So Rebbe said to me, look, these are my convictions. I hold like Rav Moshe on it. I think he's 100% correct, but you should know, look, if you're looking for flexibility, I won't be offended. I welcome you to seek recourse elsewhere if that's what you think is right, if that's what you think you need. So even though he held strong to his convictions, he never backed down. He was unequivocal. He also acknowledged, he had the intellectual honesty and humility to acknowledge that there are those who think differently, and you know what? They may even be right on occasion. But what I learned from Rav Tendler also wasn't just about halacha, about Jewish law. In fact, even though we were studying our primary svarim, we say we're the Gemara, the Talmud, the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, our Eglei Tal, Rav Tendler, every Thursday, he would designate, be makish some time for us. He'd always pull out the end of the shiur his huge, rusty old Medrash Rabbah off the shelf. And as many of us are likely familiar, while the Talmud is the main corpus of Jewish law, of halacha, Medrash Rabbah is the main corpus of Jewish ethics. Now, of course, halacha is ethical, but the more the stories, the narratives, the homiletical teachings of the rabbis. Rav Tendler said, he lamented actually, that many great scholars, many people who are otherwise great Talmidei Chachamim, have neglected Medrash Rabbah. They haven't studied it. And so he would always make time for us to study Medrash Rabbah, not just to study Jewish law, but to understand the broader ethical underpinnings of our faith. And Rav Tendler truly lived what we learned. He was truly a very ethical, very moral, a very righteous person. Rav Tendler, Rebbe wouldn't want to waste time. He wanted to maximize our time during Shir when we learned together. But nonetheless, he had his phone with him because he's answering life and death shilas, and he expects urgent calls all the time. One story that remains with me was one of the staff members at REITS, at the rabbinical school at YU. He had just recently had a grandchild that was born in Israel, but was in critical condition, put in the NICU right away in Hadassah Hospital. And Rav Tendler, when he was called and he was told about that, he immediately got on his phone. He called his granddaughter, I believe his granddaughter, who was a doctor at Hadassah Hospital, and asked her as soon as she could to go to the family there and offer whatever she could in order to comfort them. And this gave a great measure of solace to the family in America who thought there was nothing they can do. Rav Tendler interceded and he sought a way in order to help those that he could. And it didn't have to be just poskening medical ethics shilos, but also really practically doing things to help people who were in dire straits. But on a more humorous and more light note, going back to my relation with Rav Tendler and the nature of our one-to-one learning that we had. So at the time, I was a shul meshiv. I worked in educational capacity with one of the shiurim for the undergraduate students at YU during their Beis Medrash time to help them. And the issue was there were some days that I had that responsibility back to back with Rav Tendler, with my time with Rav Tendler. So what we would have to do is, I would have to eat lunch at some point. And Rav Tendler, thank God, was very understanding. He let me bring my lunch to Shir. So every day I would come with my same Tupperware with honey bunches of oats in it. I come with my thermos with cold milk from home. And while we're learning, I take the thermos out, I pour the milk in. And as we're learning, I'd be like shoveling in the honey bunches of oats as we went along. And he was totally okay with that. One day, I have my thermos. I must have screwed it on really tight. And I'm just, whenever you try to get like a pickle jar open, and it's impossible. It was one of those moments. I kept trying and trying and trying, and it wouldn't budge. Rav Tendler, who was 93, 94 years old at the time, he reaches over to the thermos. He picks it up, and he starts working on it himself to try to get it open. And while he didn't successfully get it open, he did budge it just enough that I was able to do the makip apatish and get it off, all because of his efforts. And it was moments like that that Rav Tendler certainly felt, and I say this in the most loving and positive way, felt much less like a Rosh Yeshiva to me and very much, much more like a grandfatherly figure. The small, subtle interactions like that. And so one day, again, taking place in his office, we come in and there's boxes of Sfarim everywhere, boxes of books on the floor everywhere. What happened? The university, they moved him from first hall, from one building to Gluck, which is nice. It's a nicer accommodations there. What they forgot to do was to stock the books on the shelf. You're not going to let this 90-something-year-old elderly gentleman start picking up all these heavy Sfarim putting on the shelf. So, of course, I offer my Rebbe. I said, look, I'll find time. When I have a break, I'll come up. I'll help Rebbe. You'll tell me where to put the storm. I'll put them on the shelf for you. And Rav Tendler put his foot down. He said, no. Listen to his integrity. He said, no. If you're going to help a member of the staff of the university, you need to be compensated for your time. Like, Rebbe, you're my Rebbe. I'm supposed to help you. Let me help you. He said, no. This is the university's responsibility. They'll find a way to do it. If they get you to do, if they compensate you, that's okay. But, you have a wife, you have bills you need to pay, your time is precious, I'm not going to let you do it. And I went back to the office. I said, I would offer to help, but he wants you to send some of the staff members to do it instead. He doesn't want to take advantage of me or even come close to taking advantage. And I really appreciate it because it's always it's uncomfortable for me in my rabbinic role. Sometimes I ask volunteers, you know, can you help with the lulav distribution? Can you help us organize the shul roll of Torah? And sometimes, like, you know, I know people volunteer, they want to do a mitzvah, but it's like a tinge of guilt in me. Like, I feel like I'm taking advantage of people almost. And Rav Tendler wanted to stay very far away from that. And so I really admired that subtle integrity that he showed in just these small moments. No one else was watching. I was the only one who knew about it. And I was very impressed by it. But then came COVID-19. Then came the period of Zoom. The issue was that Rav Tendler was ensconced in his home in Muncie, and he was essentially by himself for a while. There was, I think, a good month at the beginning after YU closed down that we spoke on the phone, but we really couldn't get Shear back on the road. I mean, I was still adjusting, figuring things out with my family either. We know it was a huge upheaval then. And it took like a month and a half till he finally got on Zoom. What was the issue? According to what he told me, I don't know if it was Reitz or YU or somebody said they were going to eventually have somebody come over or someone instruct Rabbi Tendler how to get Zoom on his computer. Right? He's a 90-something-year-old man. I mean, many of us here are younger than 90, and we also struggled with getting Zoom on our computers. So alachas kama v'kama, certainly for him. What happened? Rav Tendler gets on the phone with me and he's expressing his frustrations. He says, instead of sending some young guy like you over who has basic fluency in technology, what do they do? I'm not going to say his name. Some Rosh Yeshiva in his like 60s and 70s come over to help Rav Tendler install Zoom on his computer. You know, like, oh, you know, like Rav Tendler's nice. And maybe someone's like, you know, 15, 20 years younger. He's a strapping young lad who knows how to use Zoom. This Rosh Yeshiva didn't know what he was doing either. He couldn't get Zoom on Rav Tendler's computer either. And so we had to go like another few weeks until somebody, a family member, I don't know who it was, got over there and finally got Zoom on his computer for us to continue learning together. But, you know, it's like, I don't know what the thought process was. I mean, it was very kind of that Rosh Yeshiva to drive over there. I certainly don't want to minimize that, but it was very humorous, if not frustrating, when Rav Tendler had to go through that. But before he got on Zoom, so we'd have phone conversations. We tried to do Shear. We tried to learn on the phone. It wasn't so easy. And what I was impressed was that Rav Tendler, it showed a certain degree, again, of humility and willingness to learn MS, to learn the truth from wherever it comes from. That Rebbe would, you know, he would bounce ideas off me. He would call me up to almost... It was weird, like, consult my opinion on a halachic matter. Like, here you have on a Gedolei Olam, a Gedolei Hador. Why is he, like, asking this pipsqueak Talmud of his what he thinks about a halachic matter? But nonetheless, one of the issues that came up the first Pesach of COVID, especially back when we thought that COVID transferred with touching, or even if you were, like, 50 feet apart outside. So the issue is, generally, before Pesach, you want to sell your chametz. What do? You fill out a shtar harsha. You fill out a power of attorney document and you give it to the rabbi. And then what do? The rabbi gives you the pen. You lift it up and it's not actually a kinyan. A lot of people think when they do that, they're giving me the chametz so that I can then sell it to Chris. That's not actually how it works. You are simply appointing me. Your chametz is still yours. You appoint me to sell it on your behalf, power of attorney. So everyone does this. You lift the pen, you lift a handkerchief, and that concretizes your intentions to appoint me. So Rav Tendler said, what am I supposed to do this year during COVID? So what he devised was that they would take the shtar harsha, they take the document, and they put it in his mailbox, in his reshus, in his domain. And that way, that would work well enough as a concretizing action to solidify their appointment of him to sell the chametz on their behalf. But he wasn't sure, you know, he was going back and forth, and he asked me my opinion on it. I said, Rabbi, I think that's a wonderful idea. I love the svar behind it. And I believe that's what he actually did in the end. People printed the documents and then they put it in his mailbox. And it was, but again, I was really taken by the humility that Rav Tendler would just call up a Talmud and say, what do you think? What do you have to say about this? So again, like on the one hand, we know Rav Tendler in the public sphere as this bombastic force who would propound what he believed to be emes, what his convictions. But nonetheless, he was willing to, again, find truth wherever it might come from. I want to share. Let me see if I could share on the screen. I want to share some some photos over here. Let's see if I just get a thumbs up if you you see the photo, the slides. Okay, good. Thank you. So, you know, just a few photos I wanted to share. Number one, this is actually, I don't know if you could tell, I look a little young, maybe slightly younger in here. I guess for those of you who are like 70s, 80s, like you look the same. But this was after our first year of learning together when I took your day out with Rev Tendler. And you see in quotation, I put my Chavrusa. We learned one-on-one. It wasn't Chavrusa. He was the Rebbe still. You know, definitely wasn't a level playing field. But I actually, before this photo was taken, I was leaning down, scrunching over at Rebbe's chair to get a photo. He said, no, I'm standing up for you, all right? I'm not going to make you bend down. I'm going to stand up to take this photo with you. And mind you, I mean, Rebbe had a walker at the time. It wasn't a simple matter. Every time he got up, it was a whole avoda. But nonetheless, you could see him standing straight up over there to take a photo. Rather than make the Talmud bend down, he got up to meet the Talmud. So here, actually, my friend and colleague, and you guys know who he is in Stanford, Rabbi, now Rabbi, I believe, Rabbi Noah Marlow. He was walking through the Beis Medrash at YU at the time, and I'm very thankful to him. He snapped this photo over here, a candid photo of us learning what I think may have been a Mishnah Berurah before Pesach time here in the Beis Medrash. And what I actually noticed later on, if you look over here, that's either a set of Dibros or Igros Moshe right above Rav Tendler's head. So very appropriate of Moshe's Sfarim are actually situated right above Rav Tendler's head here in the photo. It's something I only noticed later on. So here's just a random photo of me. I came into the room. This is the office that Rav Tendler and I learned in. And he didn't notice that I walked in. I walked in very subtly, and I actually snapped a quick photo of Rebbe just, you know, marking up his sefer, preparing for shiur, and I'll have to frame it at some point and get it onto my wall along with everything else. And here's a side photo. Rav Tendler, of course, was a big proponent of Techeles. He claimed we found the Merculus, Trunculus, whatever you call it in the Latin. We found the source for the blue dye. And so here he is demonstrating what Techeles looks like and elaborating upon the Dina. This over here is something I found actually just last night, I believe. This is great. Can you see what he has over here, what Rav Tendler has here in the photo? What he has, now you might think it's either a gefilte fish or it's a pastry, a bread. It's actually a cow's udder. In Yoridea, we learned about kichal. And there's a whole kashrus conundrum with udders because it's meat with milk inside. And Chazal were afraid that if you eat the udder with milk, even though it's mutter really, people think that you can eat basar v'chal, you can eat meat and milk together. And so Rav Tendler wanted to show us the anatomy of an udder. And so he actually brought an udder here into a classroom. Why? I doubt he got clearance on this, by the way. One of our doctor friends looked at this photo and she's like, oh my God, he wasn't even wearing gloves when he did this. But you can see on YouTube, I won't play it now, that he took he cut it open to show us the milk inside. You'll see in the video, he was saying like, where'd all the milk go? Apparently, the udder that he bought, I don't know where you buy an udder from, I guess the butcher, wherever you go, they must have drained the milk out of it. So he's very disappointed. But again, how many Rebbeim bring an udder to class? I think there's a Talmud of Rabbi Shimshon Nadel, I believe is his name, who's a student of Tendler. He commented on the post that I shared of this. He said that he remembers when he was taking Nida with Rav Tendler. Rav Tendler brought in index cards with Bedika cloths on there, with blood from menstruation on there. And he passed it around the room and said, "Nu, is this a kesem, right? Does it make her a nida? Is this problematic? Is it more than a gris? What's the, well, not a gris, it wouldn't matter actually. It's a Bedika cloth. But nonetheless, you know, can you look at the maros on here and determine what we're looking at? Or is this blood that we're seeing?" So that was Rav Tendler. And this was emphasized at the funeral. He always said, you have to understand the metzias. Before you can get into the halakhic analysis, you need to know the data before you can apply the halakha. If you have the wrong facts, you're going to misapply the halakha. The classic sugya of killing lice on Shabbos. So this story I want to share, I'll come back to the photo in just a moment. I'll show it to you. So this was a very special moment. Rav Tendler and I, of course, I had unfettered access to Rav Tendler. We learned one-on-one in his office. Eventually, as you saw in one of the previous photos, eventually we went down to the Beis Medrash to learn together. And I figured, look, if we're learning in his office, I have one-to-one access to Rebbe. At the time, Marissa had finished graduate school in speech-language pathology, and she was about to start her job in about a week from that time. So we figured, I'm going to learn in yeshiva that day. I'm going to learn with Rav Tendler. Why doesn't she come up and join our chavrusa? I guess a chabura, a tri-chavrusa, whatever you want to call it. And Rav Tendler was so excited. In fact, I spoke to Rabbi Chaim Bronstein, who was the previous, for the longest time, the administrator of REITs. And Rabbi Bronstein said, whatever Rav Tendler saw him, he would always express how excited he was and how much he loved this experience that Marissa, my wife, joined us for our chavrusa. And let me bring it back on the screen over here. So it was such a special experience learning with both my Rebbe, both my wife. We were all together. And so I said to Rebbe, I really want to just remember this beautiful, treasured moment that we had together. And it's really, honestly, for him and for me also, I think this is one of the most treasured moments I had with Rebbe, and one of the most treasured moments I had in my life in general. So I wanted to remember it. So right before I took the photo, I took a selfie, Rebbe quickly, we're done learning for today. Marissa's about to close her Gemara. And Rav Tendler says, no, keep your Gemara open. She says, why? We're done learning. He says, because people are going to see this photo and they should see that women can learn Gemara as well. And so you look at the photo over here. You see, I have my Gemara open and Marissa kept her Gemara open over here so that all of you and anyone else who comes into my home and sees the photo up there, they'll see that women learn Gemara as well. And so Rav Tendler really valued the advanced Talmud study for women. In fact, he was very proud, I think, of Rachel, if not other granddaughters, that he had that studied in YU's GPATS program where they study Gemara, where women study in a graduate program to learn Talmud, to learn Gemara, and to understand how Kadosh Baruch Hu's Torah better. That being said, brace yourself, trigger warning, if I may. That doesn't mean Rav Tendler was this progressive, very far from it. Rav Tendler was as traditional as any Orthodox rabbi was on social issues, whether it be about women in Judaism, whether it be about LGBT issues. I won't elaborate on that over here. This is getting recorded. I'll get in trouble. But, you know, see, Rav Tendler could say things, not get in trouble. I have a career still, so I have to be careful. I could get in trouble. So I won't elaborate on that. But, you know, for instance, like, he would just, not to provoke even, like, this is just how he understood the way the world works. He would ask questions like, oh, so what's your wife making for Shabbos? And when we're learning your day, we're learning Kashrus, so learning Bishul and Shabbos, he'd say, oh, you see, like, does your wife do that when she makes you food? Does she use a cliche or a cliche for that? Or, you know, when your wife cooks this, does she do not bar not this way? So it was always, the assumption was, ask your wife when you get home how she cooks in the kitchen. Marissa didn't enjoy that, by the way. She didn't like that assumption. I think she forgave him nonetheless. But, I mean, between you and me, she's not here right now. I could say this. I mean, Marissa does actually do all the, but 96% of all the cooking at home. I make omelets from time to time in the morning, but that's the limit of my capacity. She claims I could do more, but I claim I'm incapable, you know. I don't know that much. So Rav Tendler would always, he actually chided her one time because he asked Marissa when we're on Zoom together during COVID, we're stuck in our apartment. Marissa was there and he asked her some new, what are you making for Pesach? She said, oh, you know, I'll probably make some chicken and we'll eat like a nice fleshing meal. Just chicken? That's it? You only make chicken on Pesach? Pesach deserves meat, deserves basar. And so Marissa's like, okay, maybe we'll have some meat on Pesach. But you know, that was like the relationship that we had. And you know, don't think that means he used this as his traditional standards, traditional understanding to disrespect women, God forbid. I remember one time, again, I was on Zoom Marissa had walked into the apartment after running an errand. And I quickly, you know, muttered, I said, oh, hi, welcome back. You know, I'm in the middle of shiur with Rav Tendler. Rebbe didn't hear what I said. He said, is everything okay? I saw you had to look to the side. You got distracted. I said, oh, you know, Marissa just walked in the door. My wife just walked in. He said, and so what did you do because she walked in? I said, oh, I said, hello. He said, that's it? All you do is say hello and your wife comes in. When your wife walks in the door, you're supposed to stand up for her and show her honor and give her your attention. And I said, oh, okay. Hi, Marissa. I stand up for her. And she's like, okay, Marissa, don't stand up. That's really weird. Don't do that. So while I can't say I adopted the practice that a tender told me to do, I certainly try to take the moral into account. And certainly respecting one's wife is a, hopefully, unequivocally, a very good value. Right, Marissa? Yeah. Okay. She agrees. So, I mean, nonetheless, again, you know, you had Rav Tendler. Rav Tendler had his shittos. Nonetheless, he believed that just because there's gender roles, and trust me, he held like Rav Moshe on gender roles. You see Rav Moshe's shuv on women wearing talis, and he explicates that very clearly. Nonetheless, he believed that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us a beautiful Torah, and why should we deprive half of our population of understanding the beauty, the sophistication that Kadosh Baruch Hu has to offer us. And Baruch Hashem, I could say at our own shul, nobody even gives a second glance when we have many women sitting around the table along with the men studying Gemara with us in our weekly Gemara class that we have. And I know I can see a number of you who are here with us now are part of that shiur. So it's a very special thing we have, and he would have loved to see that. I'll share one more thing just about Rav Tendler's last few months when he was alive. The last few months for Rav Tendler were exceedingly difficult. He broke his hip at some point and got a surgery, and from there it was really downhill. And he would be discharged from the hospital one day, but then back in for something else, an infection, another surgery. And he had all these surgeries, but it didn't stop him from teaching Torah. He lived to teach Torah. All he wanted was to teach. As I shared on Shabbos in the sermon, those who were out there in the tent or those who were there between Mincha Maariv, you heard that, as Rabbi Akiva says in the Gemara Maseches Pesachim, Yoser Mimasha Egel Rotza Linok, Hapara Rotza Lahanik. More so than the baby calf desires to drink the milk of its mother cow, its mother has an even greater desire to give and to nurture and to provide the milk for its little calf. And this is really what Rav Tendler was. As much as I love to learn from Rav Tendler, and I really did, he lived to give to his Talmidim. He lived to transmit the emes and the mesorah of our religion, of Yiddishkeit. And so even like right after having his surgery, he was immediately back at it. Let's see if we can get the slide up there. Right here, you can see I took a screenshot of it because I was just so thoroughly impressed by this. You can see he's right here. It's a hospital room. You can see him in the chair. I think he's might even be hooked up to an IV still. But the moment he was able to sit up, he was able to talk, he immediately had his family. So he told him, I'm giving shiur right now. You know, call up the boys, I'm giving shiur. And, you know, Shalom Fried related this in the funeral. They said, okay, well, Rebbe, Daddy, you know, let's get a white shirt on you so you can look respectable, look makavedik. And so they you can see they put him in a white shirt actually right here so he could give shiur. And he went right back to it. He went right back to giving shiur from his hospital room. He really persisted, and what I'm told from the family was the ability to still teach. And you see Asher Shannabrook, a Talmud that logged on as well. You can see that his desire to give shiur and to teach Torah really is what kept him going as long as he did. And so as time progressed and we came to the last few months of Rebbe's life, there was actually a huge lapse of time that I didn't hear from Rebbe, because due to whatever his illness was, his speech, his ability to talk deteriorated And it was very difficult for him to talk. I remember one time he was giving shiur. I was on, and he was there with one of his, maybe, I don't know if it was his son-in-law or a nephew. And in the middle of shiur, like, he just couldn't formulate or articulate the words anymore. And, you know, his relative actually jumped in there to finish the shiur, but it was so difficult watching. In the middle of shiur, he kind of just ran out of the energy to speak. He couldn't formulate anymore. But he kept, and middle shiur, like, he pushed his way back. And he's like, no, let me continue giving shiur. But there was, at a certain point, he was just in the hospital for a very long time, for a long period, until he passed away. One night, there are only three weddings I've been to since COVID began, as far as I recall. My brother, my brother-in-law, and my close friend, Yair Lichtman, got married recently, a few months ago. I was at the wedding, you know, first wedding in a while. The other ones were at the beginning of COVID, but first wedding in a while. Thank God everything's safe. All of a sudden, I get a buzz on my phone. I pick my phone up. I look at the caller ID and I say, oh my God, it's Rev Tendler. Like, I remember screaming out at the table and everyone's like looking at me like, what's, okay, big deal. Like, you know, got a call from a rabbi, you know, like, there's a lot of rabbis here at this wedding. Everyone from Reno was there at YU. But still, I was like so excited. I run out of the wedding hall. I answer the phone. I say, oh, Rabbi, it's so good to hear from you. It's been so long. And it was very bittersweet because on the one hand, I heard Rebbe's voice. But on the other hand, it was exceedingly difficult to hear the words that he was speaking. He had such a hard time formulating himself. It was mostly almost incoherent. But there was one thing that he repeated over and over again, and it's the one sentence that I was able to make out. The one sentence he kept repeating was, he said, the Seder HaLimud. What's going to be with our Seder HaLimud? Maisha, what's going to be with our Seder HaLimud? What are we learning next year? When are we going to continue learning? What's the next Sefer that you want to learn? What's the next area of halacha? What are you interested in right now? And he kept saying, the Seder HaLimud, what's going to be with our Seder HaLimud? And he repeated that again and again and again until finally one of the relatives, I think in the background I heard, came and said, okay, I think Rebbe, I think you need to rest now. And we got off the phone finally. And as far as I can remember, those were the last words I remember hearing from him. Our Seder HaLimud. What is going to be with our Seder HaLimud? And sadly, our Seder HaLimud, I like to believe, has come to an end, but a temporary end. Until which point I pray to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that one day in Olam Haba we'll be reunited and we'll be able to continue the Seder HaLimud that we had together here in life. And it's a difficult time right now. On the one hand, some people might say, you know, Rav Tendler lived till 95 years old, Kinei Hara. He lived a long life, both in Arichas Yamim in quantity, but also in quality. A very fulfilling life, a very productive life, beyond what most people could accomplish. And to a certain degree, one might say we shouldn't be mourning Rav Tendler, but we should be celebrating his life. That's what we say sometimes at a funeral. We're celebrating the life of Ploni Almoni. I'm a little selfish. It's a little difficult for me because I was only granted 3 years with Rav Tendler. And so it's difficult to part after such little time. But I really thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for giving me that special time with Rav Tendler. And I really am just left with the indelible impression of a man, a rabbi, Rosh Yeshiva, an individual who lived that statement of Rabbi Akiva, Yos Rimasha Egel Rotza Linok Hapar Rotza Lahanik. More than I benefited, more than I could desire to learn, more than any Talmud could desire to learn from Rav Tendler, and he had so much to offer us. He offered us, he gave us so much. His desire to give, his desire to transmit the Masorah to us, that was greater than anything else. And that's what kept him going until the ripe old age of 95. Tehi Nishmas Tzurah B'Tzurah Chaim. I wish nechama to the family, to everyone here who knew him, who joined us. I thank you for hearing just my own account, my own reflection, which again is not adequate, certainly not comprehensive, but hopefully hearing just a few stories about the legacy of my Rebbe Rav Tendler is something that can inspire us that we could follow in his ways of righteousness as well. So I want to just, it's almost 8 o'clock. I want to stop my speech over here and I'll stay on for a few minutes. I mean, I guess you could call this Q&A, so to speak. I don't claim to be an expert on Rav Tendler, but in case anyone had any questions on anything that was mentioned, I just want to give you that chance first to speak up if you have any questions or any thoughts. Toby.
I'm fascinated about his views on women learning Gemara when so few in that world approve of it even today. What was Reb Moshe Feinstein's stance on that?
It's a great question because, like we said, Rav Tendler felt very much bound by Rav Moshe. It seemed, you know, I pressed this. I asked Rav Tendler this one time, and I didn't get a straight answer from him on this. But essentially, what he said was, if Rav Moshe understood more about how, like, what Gemara learning looked like for women, and why it's being done the way I'm promoting it, he would approve of something like that. You know, if he got to see his great granddaughters learning Gemara, he would be very proud of them. And because Rav Moshe, what he was opposing, and we'll do this as a shir, I was going to do this for Simchas Torah about women dancing with the Torah as a case study in Judaism and how it deals with things like feminism. Rav Moshe was very anti-feminism. I mean, he was just anti-feminism. He was anti any ideology that sought to impose itself on the Torah. I mean, I'm sure he would say the same thing if a Republican Christians wanted to impose their views on the Torah, he would say the same thing. But the whole point of Rav Tendler was that it's not coming from a place of a social movement. We're not trying to, what do they call it? Not trying to break the patriarchy, smash the patriarchy, whatever they say. But we really just want to come closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And, you know, and this is what I believe also. If we really believe, and I believe, is that learning a Rav Chaim, you know, learning a Rav Elchanan is really like the highest kiyum of Talmud Torah. Why wouldn't we want everyone to be able to appreciate the true depth that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has given us? So that's something. I'm just going to take a look at the. It was a direct message. Thank you, Alana. Does anyone else have any thoughts or questions that I could? I'm happy to speak more in the future if there's nothing right now. It's not like a shir where, you know, you usually have like questions and you want to like, you know, schlug up someone, but was there anything else anyone wanted to inquire about? Again, I want to thank everyone for their time. Thank you so much for coming to this session where I shared my reflections. Again, thank you so much to the members of our shul, particularly thank you to our president, Toby Schaefer, for being with us. And also to those who came outside as well, Rabbi Siani, and I see Rabbi Dr. Abraham Unger, who was a Scott resident at our shul in the past, is with us as well. Thank you all for joining, and may we come together for happy occasions together in the future as well.
Amen. Thank you.